Hello and welcome to another episode of the We're Not Experts History Podcast with myself, Sarah, and James. Hello, James.
Hello.
You good?
I'm waving, by the way.
Oh, okay. James is waving, everyone.
I'm waving, hello.
That's my answer to that question.
Oh, fair enough. Typical British answer. You're right. It's
I'm breathing.
Well, that's something to be grateful for. So it's your turn today. What are we talking about? What are you talking about?
Today, I'm going to tell you about Jeff.
Jeff. Okay.
I'll leave that exciting opening now. I'm going to tell you about Jeff. So basically, I'm taking you back to the 1930s to a small isolated farmhouse owned by the Irving family, which was in a place called Cashin's Gap on the Isle of Man.
Right.
And they started to experience some initially subtle manifestations around this time, around September 1931.
Okay, so is this a spooky thing?
It sounds like
a spooky thing, but okay, yeah, sorry. Continue.
So you had them, that was very kind of you. They had some small persistent disturbances, and the farmer, Mr. Irving, and his wife and their teenage daughter, whose name I believe is Voirey, V-O-I-R-R-E-Y, initially noted some faint sounds of scratching and tapping and rustling that seemed to be coming from within this hollow void behind some partitions of this old stone dwelling they're living in.
Okay.
And now these inner walls were clad in wood cladding and proved to be ideal acoustically in transforming the very simple movements of this unseen resident into quite unnerving close disturbances. Now, initially, the family, being rational people, just thought the commotion was just an infestation of mice or rats. But they'd put down your usual traps and they'd catch nothing. There was nothing. It carried on. Whatever was making this noise was, well, the traps didn't stop it.
Okay.
So straight away, well, you assume it's a mouse or rat, you put traps down, they're not catching anything, and the noise is carrying on. So that's annoying.
Yeah, that would be quite annoying.
And now the sounds quickly become more complex and more intense, and over a period of weeks, these faint scurrying sounds evolved into a distinct animal mimicry, including they were hearing like the sounds of spitting and growling and barking.
Alongside,
they were also having high-pitched vocal noises that were quite unsettlingly reminiscent of a baby crying. And the farmer, who was getting frustrated with this and trying to intimidate whatever was trapped within his house, resorted to shouting and growling loudly back at the wall to try and confront or to scare whatever it was.
Yeah.
Only for the creature to growl back at him, just as equally, just being as ferocious as he was.
Oh, I'm moving out by that point. I'm done.
I don't know. This obviously is quite an unexpected interaction with whatever it was. It sort of triggered the next phase of this phenomenon. Here we go, it's that bloody word again. And this creature began attempting to vocalise. So as the farmer speaks to it through the thin panel, usually reciting simple nursery rhymes, as you do, whenever I think there's been a mouse in the house, the first thing I do is go and get the nursery rhymes.
Yeah, and try and sing it a lullaby as well while you're at it.
Exactly, yeah. But this, whatever it was, started repeating the words back to him.
Oh.
And within a short time, what was just noise became full coherent sentences delivered in a loud, clear voice, which the family described as being one or two octaves higher than a human voice and being quite high, screechy noises.
Oh.
When he was asked, this thing was asked, well, who are you then? He said his name was Jeff, and he insisted it was spelled G-E-F. And he also declared that he was an extra, extra clever mongoose.
Oh.
It gives his own identity, this hidden resident,
And yeah, I suppose you've launched the family into quite a strange situation.
That's the last thing I'd expect.
Yes, it's a mongoose. After all that, it's a talking mongoose. I can't believe we put traps down.
Yeah.
So, following this development of the clear speech from Jeff, the family quickly, well, he installed himself really with the family as a highly unique, I suppose, contradictory member of their small household. So he wasn't really a pet. He was, well, I suppose, a lodger, really, just wasn't paying.
No.
But
I'm assuming they haven't seen him at this point. He is just behind the panelling.
He is. Yeah, he's just invisible to them.
They can hear him. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but he's just living within the woodwork and the cavities in the ceiling. And it became an almost constant source of tittle-tattle and entertainment. And his voice, this high-pitched shriek that could at times sound very, very clear, was almost constantly present. It would interrupt conversations, it'd interject with sharp jokes, or it would burst into song. And he particularly enjoyed singing the popular tunes of the era, such as one called Carolina Moon, apparently. Sometimes changing the lyrics to more, how can we put it, dodgy.
And they're just okay with this. They're not. I mean, I would be ripping the panelling out to get this thing out.
Well, it depends on how desperate you are, how much you are willing to damage your house to get rid of a talking mongoose.
Well, to be fair, I would assume that it's a person. If something's talking to me, anyway, I don't know. Yeah. I just find it really creepy. But yeah, go on.
Okay, so I see exactly what you mean. But Jeff had he had this very turbulent relationship with the teenage daughter, Voiry Irving. While he often kept her company, provided her with I suppose amusement. She might have had a radio, but it wouldn't have been much in the way of television then. So talking mongoose is the best thing.
He I guess.
Was also very disruptive and would often scream or be banging on the walls in her bedroom until she was forced to sleep in her parents' room just to get away from the noise.
Mm.
And his general temperament would go wildly from being affectionate and comical, such as apparently once called the farmer a fat-headed gnome. Well, I'm not sure I'd see that as affectionate. Or he would be quite irritable and very demanding, often insisting that he'd shout at him, put the bloody gramophone on if he got bored.
It's just not...
So this invisible entity, I suppose the function extended far beyond just his conversation, and it positioned himself as a kind of unseen spy and a domestic aide. And Jeff boasted, he claimed he had this ability to leave the house and would ramble across the island whilst remaining invisible, obviously. And he would frequently prove this by gathering little bits of story, tittle-tattle, chatter from the nearest villages. And he'd have information about the private lives and the conversations and basically the personal business of the neighbours, which lent support to the family's incredible claims that their house was inhabited by a clever mongoose.
Yeah, nosy mongoose.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think if you've got a mongoose who's talking to you, you're going to interrogate him. And he claimed that he'd been born in New Delhi in India in 1852, which would have put him in his 80s at the time.
Right.
He claimed to be the ghost of a weasel, as well as being this very extra clever talking mongoose. He were also he had demands for specific food items, which I think if you're on the sceptical side of this, which I think most sensible people are, would see it as a hint as to the origins of Jeff. And obviously, if you're a wild mongoose, their diets would consist of insects and rodents, eggs, things like that. But his favourite treats were very human, and perhaps that of a teenage girl. He'd often request the chocolate. Family to, yeah, basically chocolate, biscuits, bacon, and occasionally sausage. And they'd leave these little bits out for him on a plate, which they would then mysteriously find he'd been eaten.
Oh.
Yeah,
this is freaky.
Yeah, but he also claimed to have like a protective use as well, and he would act as this weird guardian of the house, and he would issue a sharp verbal warning when strangers or unfamiliar dogs approached the house. So obviously he was warning the occupants rather than shouting out the window, telling people where to go. But he also had this mischievous streak, which included outright menacing behaviour, where he'd throw small objects at the family members or guests, and occasionally delivering quite explicit threats of violence. It's like if he was bothered, he would kill all of the poultry on the farm, which makes more sense for a weasel or whatever he's claiming to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's ghost of a weasel, and then he says a mongoose.
What a pleasant individual.
He's a weasel mongoose. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But he's this like, constant activity and bizarre revelations cemented his status not as just a house ghost, but as almost an earthbound spirit, I've read, capable of being able to manipulate his surroundings. It's strange. Yeah. Considering he was invisible, he was seen. I think he was described by the daughter as being about the size of a rat with a big yellow fluffy tail.
Oh.
Is that a mongoose? Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm going to have to Google mongoose to see if it looks like a rat with a bushy tail.
I think they do look a little bit rat-like, I think.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm thinking more weasel.
They are like rodent-y type things, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think they're bigger.
Hmm. But you do get big rats.
But these are quite like elongated things, and I'm sure they're what I'm thinking of are the ones that they kill snakes. They're quite a vicious little thing.
Let me have a look. I'm going to Google it.
Yeah, while you're looking that up. So, while all this is being claimed, it's making the newspapers, and it quickly transcended. As I say, it transcended the local gossip of the Isle of Man and spread across Britain and probably across the world when you've got such a daft story. And this little farmhouse.
Yeah, it looks a bit like. Sorry, I just butted in. It looks a bit like. Kind of a cross between a weasel and. What's that other thing called?
You're not helping.
A meerkat.
Come on, goose. A meerkat, a weasel and a meerkat.
Yeah, because there's a picture here of one standing up on its hind legs, but there is a picture of one eating a snake, so that's correct what you said about the snake.
That is what I'm thinking of, yeah.
Yeah, and it has got kind of a, not a bushy tail, but, I mean, it's definitely rodent-y looking. I mean, it doesn't look like a rat, it looks like some form of rodent, yeah. I wouldn't want that in my house.
Well,
especially if it was talking to me. Yeah, but if it was talking to me and I knew it was behind the walls, Anyway, sorry.
Yes. Anyway, so this everything that's going on in this isolated little farmhouse, it become like a perfect testing ground for paranormal investigators of the time. So obviously you've now got this intense scrutiny. At first, publicly identify the farmer as James Irving, his wife as Margaret and their daughter as Voirin. The families were quite open about the phenomenon. And most of this was driven by the father, James. And that is what led to the visits from these researchers. Mm-hmm. One of the most significant and one of the most famous was Harry Price, who was very famous for the investigations of Bawdy Rectory in Essex, North Essex.
Yeah. I knew I'd heard that name.
Yeah, he was the director of the National Laboratory for Psychical Research, and he went along to the farm in 1935 with a journalist called Richard Lambert, and they conducted a thorough, quite frustrating investigation. And despite the extensive search they made for Jeff,
they failed to definitely see or even hear Jeff. Oh. And Jeff, Price's scrutiny, he focused very much on the structure of the farmhouse and observed the construction with the hollow gap between exterior stone and interior wooden cladding effectively made the entire house what he called a speaking tube or a sounding board.
Right.
That provided perfect conditions for any voice to appear disembodied and travel throughout the house.
Right.
And they wrote a book called The Haunting of Cashin's Gap, and it covered the case, and I'd say cemented its place into paranormal history, and the fact that we're still talking about it now. And there's almost certainly hundreds of other podcasts that cover this.
Probably.
I haven't bothered looking.
Probably better than ours. But anyway.
I don't think there's any probably about that.
No.
There was also another investigator. There was a Hungarian-American parapsychologist called Nándor Fodor, which is a brilliant name for a parapsychologist. Mm. I don't know why. It fits. And he spent a week at the farm in 1935. He was deeply steeped in psychoanalysis and began to steer the explanation away from the supernatural towards a psychological interpretation of what was going on.
Mm.
And it was him who became convinced that the phenomena, if not a conscious hoax, were likely a form of poltergeist activity linked to the subconscious energy or emotional tension of the family, particularly the young teenage daughter, which is how that usually comes up. Whenever there's a poltergeist, there is usually a young teenager.
Normally, yeah.
Quite often a female in there, yeah. Yeah, it shows. I think it goes to show just what trouble women are. Anyway, Jeff often made himself...
I have to agree with that, but anyway.
Yeah. Whenever these people were about, Jeff would make himself scarce. So, yeah, sometimes he'd claim his invisibility with a protective measure against unbelieving investigators and, sceptical podcasters. And occasionally he would retaliate by throwing stones at their heads. And this... constant failure of these experts to capture any definitive proof, like photos or recordings of Jeff, it just made people even more sceptical about the whole story.
That must be so frustrating if you're the family in that situation and you... I mean, I'm not saying this is true or false because I don't know, but imagine you are in that situation and you are witnessing this firsthand and you know it's real. But then whenever you try and find the proof or the evidence, you just can't get it. Like, that must be so frustrating because it will make you out to be like, you're lying.
Yeah. But there's an invisible talking mongoose in my house. Why would no one believe me?
It's like when you go to the doctors with something you've been suffering with for like a month and then all your symptoms disappear the minute you walk into the surgery and then the doctor's like, well, what's wrong with you? I don't see any sign of this. And it's like... I swear I'm ill. It's a bit like that.
You can't x-ray pain. So I suppose that's another thing. If you've got pain somewhere, there's nothing, no reason why. It's your word against theirs, yeah.
Yeah. So it's a bit like that.
A little bit.
But,
yeah. So I imagine a doctor should have been involved in this. Moving on. But the claims of the Irving family were, they were damaged at one point because the greatest support that they had for the notion of this hoax come from the analysis of the very, very small physical evidence that they were able to provide. Mm. So in 35, James Irving meticulously sent samples of the creatures, what he claimed was the fur, to Harry Price, who then passed it on to the Zoological Society so they can analyse it. And the results came back as quite conclusive, and they said the hairs didn't belong to a mongoose, a rat, or any small exotic mammal, but they said it's a form of a longish... It came from a longish-haired dog. And...
Let me guess, they've got a dog.
Price confirmed this by obtaining a sample from their dog, a Mona, who was a sheepdog, finding the hairs to be absolutely identical. So, yeah. There was also later on other attempts to produce more proof, But it met with the same sort of like inconclusive or contradictory results. And the Irvings had supplied plaster casts of Jeff's paws and teeth made in modelling clay. And that, once again, these were analysed and it revealed a bit of a puzzling disparity in the paw prints, where the front prints were disproportionately large, measuring an immense 8 to 10 centimetres for a creature only a foot long. So his feet were too big for what should have been a small animal. But then, this is, yeah, I don't know how you'd... It can't possibly be a ghost. It's strange. And they also look like the paw prints of a dog.
Same dog.
I mean, who knows? But the rear prints, they were smaller, which it was inconsistent with any known animal species. And not only that, but some critics examining photographs of the car suggested that the impressions were quite crudely made and could have been made with a stick or a small human's fingers. And the teeth marks were thought to be suspiciously like that of a small human being.
So potentially they are trying to create their own evidence, whether it's out of desperation or whether it's because it is actually a hoax and it's all just a load of rubbish.
It's not helping them.
Why didn't just whack their iPhones out and just try and get some footage that way?
Well, it makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Because that would have solved it all. Just put your iPhone on a tripod, set it to record.
My concern is if it was an iPod, the battery would have gone flat just before it started.
Yeah, that does happen quite a lot, actually.
Yeah. But then, anyway, the case fractured into three competing explanations. So you've got the hoax theory, which, funny enough, remains the most popular one.
I would have thought.
And yes, most people are assuming it's just a deliberate deception by one or more of the family members with the high-pitched voice. It's funny how many, it makes me laugh that whenever this happens, one of the theories is that one of the children is a very, very good ventriloquist. Why didn't they go into ventriloquism? Yeah. The second theory, which was supported by Nandor Fodor, the parapsychologist, he favoured a psychological phenomenon, and he suggested that Jeff was not an independent spirit, but a type of poltergeist, so an internal, external manifestation. His wording, hang on, the external manifestation of unconscious telekinetic energy stemming from the emotional or psychological turmoil of a family member, often linked to the transition of the teenage daughter into puberty.
Right, like a typical poltergeist, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I had to read it out loud because it was so beautifully worded. But the third theory is basically comes from your supernatural perspective, and it was basically that the Irvings and a minority of researchers insisted that Jeff was exactly what he claimed to be, a sentient, extra clever mongoose or interdimensional entity.
That is also possible, but...
No, I think that's hack.
I don't see why an ET would be living in somebody's wall and demanding chocolate and biscuits. It just seems a bit odd, and throwing rocks at people's heads. I think ETs have got better things to do than that. Like flying spaceships and stuff. But anyway.
At no point did he claim to be from another planet.
Yeah.
But the intensity of Jeff's phenomenon, it sort of faded I moved into the late 30s, particularly as voyeury grew older and the novelty of this invisible being sort of wore off. I suppose the newspapers get bored with it as well. And after the death of James Irving in 1945, the farmhouse was sold, and the new owner was a fella called Leslie Graham, and he claimed in 1947 to have shot and killed a strange unidentified creature that closely matched Jeff's description.
Oh.
And that sort of brought an end to the whole saga. Obviously, where's the body? This is my first question.
Yeah.
But then, also at some point, the farmhouse was destroyed. So there's no proof, there's no evidence now, physical trace of the building or this sounding board behind the walls.
No.
And that's the story of Jeff I wanted to tell you about.
Oh, so is that how it ended? I mean, so there's no kind of proof. I thought you were going to tell me at the end, oh, it was a, I don't know, a man that was hiding in the walls or something.
No evidence. It's almost certainly a hoax.
One of those, yeah. That would be my feeling.
Yeah. So I'm thinking back to the Enfield Poltergeist. So that was in the 70s. That was like 40 years after this. And obviously a lot of people say that's a hoax. And it was it Janet, her name?
I think it was something like that.
I should know it. But a lot of people said it was her who was doing it and she was making the noises. But when she was asked about this, did you fake it? She was quite unhappy to have been asked and to be accused. And she said, you couldn't possibly know what it was like. You weren't there, which is a great answer.
Yeah. That's the thing.
I still think she did it, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it? Because, yeah, we weren't there and we didn't experience it. And it's one of those things, it sounds so unbelievable, a talking mongoose, that you think, no, that can't be. That's ridiculous. But how do we know that it wasn't a talking mongoose?
Yeah, well, we don't, but we do. On the other hand, we do, yeah. Yes, I just wanted to tell you Jeff's story.
Well, that was unexpected. That was the last thing I thought you were going to talk about. But yeah, bit of a weird one, to be honest. And I was kind of waiting for the punchline. I thought at the end you were going to say, it was a man, or it was a random homeless person that had found their way into the house and they were secretly living there. Because I've heard stories like that where people people living in their attics or... What's it called?
Frogging.
Frogging?
It's start with P-H. P-H-R-O-G-G-I-N-G. Frogging.
Frogging. So not like squatting. Because squatting is when you live in a house that's empty, but you move yourself in without permission.
When you illegally enter a building,
And you just live there, But...
Yeah.
So frogging is
hiding within someone's house. Yeah.
Ooh, that's creepy.
But no, it wasn't that, no. Well, unless Jeff was frogging.
Yeah, again, I guess you wouldn't know, would we? We weren't there. Well.
No, we won't know now.
No.
There you go.
One of those mysteries that, and I guess all the family have all long gone, so we won't.
Yeah, I would have thought so, yeah. There must, but there might be, whether Voyery had children or not, I don't know.
No, but, thank you for that. That was a
pleasure.
That was an interesting way to spend the last half an hour. I don't know how long we've been talking. But thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this podcast. Very random subject, but we do aim to be random. We aim to surprise. Well, James does anyway. You always find the most obscure things to talk about. My podcasts are normally more general, like general things like the Great Fire of London or the Industrial Revolution, and then you just find these really obscure things that no one knows about except for you and talk about them. But you know, it keeps it interesting. But just remember, we are not experts. Definitely not experts. I'm sure you figured that out already. Just two amateurs muddling through history.